Welcome, everyone, to the latest installment of the MP Access Show. I'm David Wharton, Editor-in-Chief with Mortgage Point and the Five Star Institute. Joining us today, we have Solomon Skolnick, who is a longtime mortgage loan officer with United Mortgage Corp. He has got about two decades of experience in the industry, and he's also the author of A Step-by-Step Guide to Financing Your Home. Welcome to the show, Skull.
Good morning, David. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I know you have been doing this for a long time, and you've seen lots of changes in the market over the two-plus decades that you've been working here. So could you talk about, in your opinion, what does it mean to be an informed home buyer in the market as it is today?
Home buyer needs to understand where they're looking, because regionally and even within the regions, the market is very different from place to place in terms of what's available, how people are paying for it, and what they're competing against when it comes to looking for other buyers. That's really been exacerbated post-pandemic, but with it being clear that there's less and less available and prices of things going up, including insurance and your taxes, people have to really understand if they can afford where they're looking, as well as understanding what a real estate agent can do to help them in the process. I know a lot of people sort of say, gee, I don't need an agent. I don't want to spend the money. You need professionals. You need a team of people who do this all the time, because it doesn't matter how smart you are, what your education is. Unless you've been through this process recently, you don't have a history of how it's currently working.
Well, obviously, you've written a book on many of these topics, and I know you speak to the importance of having a team that you can kind of serve your best interest there. A little sidebar, are there resources that you would recommend out there for helping with that education or answering these kinds of questions, or does that really best served by folks like yourself who are acting in within a professional capacity?
I think for the most part, I think people need to read books like mine, which is available for free, both as an ebook, and I will also send you a physical copy if that's what you prefer, and I will pay the freight because I want people to have that information. But talking to mortgage officers before they're even engaged in, what is the rate kind of conversation? What do you need from me? How will I make this work best for you? And then also finding a real estate agent who will represent you as a buyer's agent. It's very important to know, especially in places like New York and Connecticut, where the buyer's agent has your fiduciary responsibility. They are responsible to make sure you're protected. The listing agent is working for the person selling the home. And no matter how nice they are and how much information they give you, their interest is to the person selling the home. Their legal interest is not to you. So get somebody who's on your side.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm curious. I know it's great that you're offering this book as a free resource. Is this something with the market changing as constantly as it is that something that you update periodically, or is it like, how does that work on the book process?
It starts as an ebook, and then I print it in small quantities. I change it every time it's necessary to change. So the current edition was redone in April of this year.
Awesome.
I can do it. If something changed a lot tomorrow, I could get that done. So the ebook's going to be current to the moment. And then I print small amount of copies to make sure that what I'm giving out is current. Again, because people need to know the market is changing by the minute, whether it was post-pandemic, whether it's not enough inventory, whether it's, the cost of everything going up or being in the midst of an international war.
Well, moving on, I know one of the topics that you had mentioned when we were setting this up was that pre-approval process creating kind of a false sense of security or a sense of, oh, we're good, we're done, that sort of thing. So could you talk a little bit about that, how that creates that and where those...
Yeah, please.
So in general, an agent is going to say, I need a pre-approval before I can even take you somewhere. A pre-approval or even a pre-qualification are reasonably soft documents. A pre-qualification is a conversation and somebody says you're pre-qualified. All that means is they talk to you, they know approximately what you're earning, approximately what you have in the bank. Pre-approval will go a little bit more in depth. Often the lender will look at your credit at that point. They will certainly look at some of your documents. But the important thing to know about both of those documents is that it says this is not a commitment to lend. It means that we've taken you a certain distance, But this is not cash. There is something called a TBD, or to be determined commitment, which lenders like United Mortgage, which is a mortgage bank, will create for you. The difference there is we take all of that information and give it to an actual underwriter. And the document that we give you is a commitment to lend up to a certain amount, pending your finding a property that will appraise. So you can do that. You get this without the property being identified. This is going out in the world. It is literally the equivalent of cash, because the bank is saying, we have looked at all this stuff, an underwriter has approved you for an actual loan amount.
I'm sure you probably encounter a lot of confusion between people who are hearing pre-approval or pre-qualification, or I don't know that anybody that doesn't know what they're doing would even know what the TBD commitment means. So how do you kind of walk people through that process and clarify what they do? Is it a matter of here's what you need to know, and or just kind of don't look at these other things? Here's the part that's germane to you.
Oh, I mean, here's what you need to know, which is that either of the other documents, the pre-qualification or pre-approval, will have a line. No matter who the lender is, there will be a line that this is not a commitment to lend. So this is a, we like you a lot, but we don't love you yet. And people need to know that when they're going in against other people with pre-approvals, they're on the same footing. If they're going against people with cash, they are outdistanced immediately. By going in with a commitment to lend from a bank, you are equal to cash, but you're certainly better than the people who are pre-approved, because that we have taken care of underwriting you as a borrower. Now it's a matter of, let's find the property and make sure that that's what you need, that's what you want, and it's worth what you're being asked to pay for it.
Well, you mentioned that's kind of as good as cash. Are there ways, is it just that equivalency that helps finance buyers be able to compete in obviously competitive markets across the country? Does it give you any sort of an edge, or is it just literally, let's just like, this is the same thing as this?
No, it gives you an edge over the people with just a pre-approval, for sure. And it gives you the competitive equality with somebody coming in with cash, because you have been taken care of. A bank has literally put the money in front of you. And so your bid up to the amount that you've been approved for, not pre-approved, but actually approved for, puts you in a stronger position. Now, somebody else can then come in with additional money over the asking price, and you don't have that. That's a different story, but that's not a bank. That's not about being pre-approved. That's about what's available to you and how much you're willing to spend. And there's no, in markets like Westchester County and parts of Connecticut that are highly competitive and very high priced, people are coming in, substantially over asking, in the attempt to simply beat other people out. I know some real estate agents who at this point will back away from representing buyers who are looking only for listings, because when they go in with a buyer and a buyer comes in with 7 or 8 or 10 offers and can't get it done, saying that's not a good use of their time.
I'm curious, you've been doing this a long time. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you encounter time and time again of people who are misunderstanding the process or making assumptions where based on information that's just not correct?
Well, the first question that I always cringe at is, what's the rate? Well, there is no the rate. The rate depend is really specific to each individual. And what I mean by that is each bank will create what's called a PAR, PAR rate. And that means they're not asking you to pay anything to get it, and they're not going to give anything back to you. And then there are going to be a list of variations that says, if I pay the bank a quarter of a point, 0.25%, can I get a slightly lower rate? If I pay them more, do I get a rate below that as well? If I want a higher rate and am willing to get a credit from the bank so that I can pay some of my closing costs with their cash, that's another way of going. And the rate, so I call that the cost of the rate rather than what the rate is. And then the other things that go into the cost of the rate for you that create the rate is, what is your credit score, your FICO scores? What is your debt to income ratio, the amount of money you will be borrowing plus what you currently owe against what you create in income each year? And the other thing is going to be the debt, the loan to value of the home. The more you put down as equity up to a point, the higher the rate that you're going to be able to acquire for less money is going to be. So those are the three things the banks look at.
Well, I want to mix in a little bit of personal amidst all these database questions. So I find it's interesting how people end up in this industry. I'm curious, what was your path to where you are now? How did you end up in this business, and how is it taking you to where you are now?
Okay, so my first career was in trade book publishing. I ran imprints at places like Simon and Schuster and Random House. And then when ebooks came onto the scene, when somebody got a Kindle, my wife and I, who was also in the same business but doing something very differently, said, "You know what? We probably shouldn't both be in the same business anymore because we don't know what's going to happen to it." So I said, "I'm going to find something else to do." I went upstairs. I came down the next morning and I announced to my family that I was going to become a mortgage banker. And they looked at me and they said, "Say what?" And they said, at that point, we've been living in New York for our entire lives, but the Westchester area, for many years at that point. And they said, there are two things that are not going away here, money and real estate. So I decided that that was something that I wanted to do. I also realized very quickly that people in banking were more about numbers than they were about communication at that point, having had mortgages to buy homes. And I realized that coming from book publishing, where conversation and speaking to people and communication is the key, I could bring something a little bit different to it. So I thought by becoming an educator, if you would, that would help me in doing that. And I was very fortunate in that the people I worked for, first as a broker and then later as bank, were very helpful in getting me up to speed. The other important thing is I came into the business in 2006. So in 2008, there was a crash. And up until then, there was no licensing to be a mortgage originator. Virtually anybody could do it. There was very little in the way of background checks. Once that process changed, I was in that first group of people that got a lot of education and had to get a license and have it renewed each year with additional education. So I felt that that was strengthening my position as somebody who could help people get financed.
Obviously, an interesting time to come into the mortgage, right? As that crash was happening, what are some of the most interesting changes you've seen in the market and the way the process works in those years since then?
Well, one of the most interesting changes, because costs went up, because the cost of homes went up so substantially because of the pandemic, a lot of people who would have were empty nesting and would have downsized at a certain point in their life were less able to do it. And I now call it at best side-sizing, where they're spending a little bit less for the smaller place or for a place where somebody else mows the lawn or takes care of, a lot of the overhead things. Than used to be. So that's become part of the logjam of the homes that would typically open up for people to be able to move in as they're beginning to build families. My wife and I just sold a house that we lived in, which is my background, for 37 years. When we went to look at that house, there were probably a half a dozen houses within three blocks for sale because people who were empty nesting were doing it. When we put this on the market, it was the only home for sale for blocks and blocks and blocks, because a lot of people were stuck in place, not wanting to be stuck in place. So that's been a very big change. The other real change is that there's been a strengthening of the banks who are mortgage banks, like the one that I work for, that we don't do anything else. We don't do credit cards. We don't do checking accounts. We're not interested in getting you to buy other things. The banks that do that are looking for you to be a customer across lines. And that changes the way your relationship grows with the bank, because we don't want anything from you. We want to give you the money and we want to make sure that you're stable and in a good place to do it, and then go about your business. And so those kinds of banks like ours have become stronger over the past few years as the larger banks realize how expensive it is to do mortgages and don't necessarily want to do it with the same aggressiveness they used to.
I'm curious, coming from your previous career, what was the biggest part of the learning curve? What was the hardest thing to pick up? And were there, adding to that, were there skills from your previous career that ported over? I assume obviously working with a book, but beyond that.
Well, again, being conversational, giving people information, which is I was accustomed to doing. But some of the biggest changes was, dealing one-to-one with consumers. I had been dealing with authors and editors and, sending something out into a universe, hoping that it stuck. Here I was talking to individuals and had to very quickly get a sense of what was their life like, what was important to them, where did they live now, where did they want to live. So I needed to, adjust very quickly. I think I did ultimately, but that was the biggest change for me. The rest of it was, taking information and using it properly, which I had hoped I had done before anyway.
Well, I want to throw in a question. Obviously, one of the biggest hot topics that everyone's talking about is artificial intelligence. How's it going to impact things? How's it going to impact me as a mortgage broker? How's it going to impact the home buyer? Beyond just AI, as technology as a whole, how do you see it changing the marketplace, home buying process, and what you do specifically in the next 10 years? If you have thoughts on that.
So it has changed significantly already because when I first got into the business, you had a stack of papers that had to be in a specific order. They got put in a manila binder. They had to have a certain kind of a clip, and you handed them to somebody who brought them to an underwriter who then, went page by page by page by page. So, I mean, you literally cannot find a paper application anymore. Everything is pretty much online. A smart mortgage originator, I think, stays on the phone with or on a Zoom with the applicant, because even though they're online to your company, walk them through, explain to them what those different pieces are, how to get the correct answers to the questions being asked for the mortgage itself. The other good thing is that, the ability to get somebody an answer more quickly than in the past, whether it's through desktop underwriting or whether it's getting it to an underwriter quickly, because the documents and the information can move much more quickly than they used to, has certainly made that process more efficient. If you're getting, the correct information and you're giving and you're supporting people through their process.
Have you seen, obviously we have multiple generations now in the home buying market, from the boomers mostly aging in place all the way down to Gen Z entering the marketplace. What have you seen as far as changing needs, as or how they prefer to be approached, how they prefer to interact? What have you seen from your end?
Well, what I have found very, it's the right word, very pointedly is that the amount of money that a lot of the buyers are getting as gifts from their family members has increased exponentially. And therefore, the involvement of the person who is giving them the money as a gift often is a little bit more probing than it might have been several years ago. Okay. Also, when people are first moving up, I think unless somebody says to them, what do you need to know about where you're going to live? So one of the very small things, but something that became important, the village that we were in was only one of two in the entire county where there were no school buses. In New York State, the rule is if you live 2 miles or more from the school, the school, you must get a bus. Well, our village was so small, and the schools were centralized. If you lived more than 2 miles away, you were somewhere else. And so we had people coming up from the not suburbs, saying, "Where did your children pick up the school bus?" And I would jokingly say, "In another town." And so that kind of, that's information that's important. What when you're moving to particular places, in addition to, what are the religious organizations nearby if that's important to you? Yes, of course, the education and the school districts are important, but that's the easy thing to find information about. Of course, your real estate agent can't tell you that, but they can move you to places that will give you information that's been culled in eight different ways to show you what the school districts look like. But the other important things, what are the cultural things available to you nearby? What is transportation really like in a post-pandemic world? Whether it's train, bus, subway, or if you're living and working at home. So those are or really have become much more important, because I certainly find more of the potential buyers now, at least one of the two or the three or the four, are potentially working at home, but they're not, but they're not remote workers. They are, that's work out of.
Yeah.
So yes, they are remote, but they're not, out in the field. So that's been a change. And so the what you're looking for in the home, what it provides to you in terms of bedrooms, bathrooms, and quote unquote office space. Also locally, how good is the cable or the internet or anything else that you need for business access. So those are much more recent and new and important things in the conversation.
Well, circling back to the process itself, what are some things that buyers should look at beyond just that interest rate when they're comparing multiple loan options?
Well, they need to talk to the originator about what's the nature of this note. So one of the things is, if the rates go down after you're closed, will your lender give you a modification rather than require you to refinance? And a modification is moving the rate down for a flat fee rather than having to have everything done from the beginning again.
Yeah.
Also, as people move forward and they have some money and they see, I'd like to own more of my home, I'd like equity. If I put a large amount of money in, will my lender recast my loan? And by recast, I mean, will they now take the lower amount that I owe and make my payment without changing my rate or my term in the following months lower? Those are things that most potential buyers don't even know are questions.
Yeah.
Things that are asked because, that mortgage, that loan note is going to be with you for a long time. The other thing is when people say, I've been told I must have a 30-year fixed. And I say, without blinking, especially in 2026 as opposed to 1942, the number of 30-year notes that close at 30 years is infinitesimal. It's not
Yeah.
how we live. Excuse me. Before the pandemic, 5 to 7 years was the average of somebody holding on to a note. It became a little bit longer during the pandemic for obvious reasons because people wanted to stay safe. It's starting to move back to sort of 7 to 11. But understand that the 30-year note is going to be, in terms of the interest rate, the highest interest rate you're going to end up with because the bank's being asked to hold on to something in theory for that amount of time. And also the likelihood of you holding on to it, whether you're going to refinance because rates change, refinance to take cash out, or because this is a home with 2 bedrooms and in 5 years you need one with 3 bedrooms. So please, look at what the choices are. So a 30-year note does have other flexibilities as long as it's not the 30-year fix. Within that, I say to people, there are adjustable rate mortgages, and adjustable rate doesn't mean that it can go haywire. It means that you're going to get a rate for a certain fixed amount of time, and that will be told to you up front. And the note will also show you what's the lowest that rate can be and what's the highest that that rate can be. So it's not uncontrollable. It's not going to run you over. You obviously are going to have to be approved for it. So the bank will make sure, or the lender will make sure, that you can afford to do this if things change. But have those conversations. Don't walk in and say, I need a 30-year fix, because likelihood is you don't.
Obviously, affordability is a big topic that has been, I mean, it's been a topic as long as I've been doing this. I'm sure probably as long as you've been doing this. We've seen lots of people kind of throwing anything they can think of at the wall to try to solve this problem. We've had the government propose 50-year mortgages. We've had all these different conversations. Do you think there is any real relief on the horizon as far as affordability, or are we just kind of at the mercy of all these different factors that have got us ensnared where we are now?
At the moment, we're at the mercy more than anything else of taxes and insurance costs. So once you lock into a mortgage, whether it's for 3, 5, 7, 10, or 110 years, your rate is your rate. Your cost is going to be your cost. The ones that you can't control are what your taxes are, and you certainly can't control insurance. And depending on where you live in the country, you may become uninsurable. Fortunately, up in where we are, I am in the Northeast, that's not been the case. But that's a real concern. And if you're going to be financed, you're going to have insurance. You don't have the option of not having insurance, and people need to understand that. So I think that, being flexible and forward thinking as much as possible, understanding that those things will go up. Again, it's pretty easy if you're looking at a particular village or town, especially outside of the city, how have the rates for taxes gone up? in that particular place? How well is it managed? Not dissimilar to somebody buying into a co-op. When you're buying into a co-op, you're looking at, how they run their money. How do they take care of that building? Well, how does the village or town that you're moving into historically, take care of their money? And then the insurance part, we're all at the mercy of the insurers. There's no, I don't know of an easy way around that. And if you do, please tell me and I will follow.
Yeah, are you seeing how much impact are you seeing as far as where people are buying homes? Obviously, we have instances like Florida where we have insurance companies pulling out just because they can't manage with the weather issues. What are you seeing as far as are people proactively kind of reconsidering where they move to, or are people still kind of have that as a blind spot?
I really think it depends on where they are in their life cycle. So if people, are thinking of, don't have children and education is not a major issue, they might choose to continue to live in a city or urban area where they have other cultural benefits, and stay with it if they like that. If they're looking to educate their children, traditionally, over time, they've moved into suburbs where the education is taken care of by a smaller community and, in theory, is more responsive. So, we've seen obviously a lot of that continue. And then, past it, people I think are willing, if they have to work in a city on a daily basis or part of the week, are willing to travel again a bit more than the pre-pandemic because they've become accustomed to understanding if I'm only going into the city 2 days a week, it's not the same as commuting 5 days a week. I can go in for an hour and 10 instead of it being 45. What I am seeing, good, bad, or indifferent, is that the more expensive homes are going faster and faster, and the people that are going for those need less and less financing, or because they have a lot of money invested, the folks with whom they have it invested will lend them money against what they're holding. So they are less likely for a mortgage. Manhattan is the most amazing example. In the first half of 2025, 55% of all of the purchases were for cash, which is astounding considering you're talking about one of the most expensive markets in the country. It's not like people were spending $1.50. Certainly in Westchester and Fairfield, where again, most of my business is, we're seeing more of that than we had in the past, although there are still people looking for financing. But yes, we're seeing that. And then we're seeing more and more first-time home buyers looking for money to be given to them towards their down payments, different grants. The problem with that in some of the more expensive areas that if you're eligible for that, you're not likely making enough money to actually be able to afford something. So if you're below the median in Westchester County, and yes, we can get you $7,500 to a down payment, but when you look at what it's going to cost you each month to live, you might have just been priced under the market.
Are there fees or loan terms that buyers should pay closer attention to, or that you see people being confused about?
They need to approach it the way they probably approach their own businesses and how they run their lives, which is give me as much information as you can about what the choices are. Tell me what the pluses and minuses are of those choices so that I can make a decision based on my current income, my future income in my mind, and what I need to create. And once that information is in front of people who are buying, they're going to make the same intelligent decisions that got them to be in a position to buy.
Is there one common mistake that you see buyers try to bring to the table that you have to course correct a bunch?
Yeah, there are at least 10, but we shouldn't go through all 10. But the point is, yes,
Like a second book there for you.
I mean, some of the simple ones is, don't buy anything big. Now, people say, gee, I can still afford it. But the point is, if you've been underwritten at a certain debt to income ratio, even if you can afford the car you've just bought the lease on, the underwriter now needs to go back and rewrite that. And yes, you may get approved again just as easily, but you've now wasted time. And time is, quite frankly, of the essence now because you're competing against other people that are going to move very, very fast. So that's one thing that people should not do. You don't need to buy the furniture before you own the house. You don't need to lease a new car unless you're walking. So don't do that. Then other important things, don't. don't apply for new credit. Again, your debt to income ratio was a certain place when you were approved. Don't alter it, even if you can afford to alter it. Wait until the day
Right.
after you close. So those are two very important things. The other thing is that people don't really understand that banks are under a great deal of pressure from the government to make sure that money is not being laundered. And so if you move money around within different accounts during this process, you may be doing so honestly, cleanly, and clearly, but the bank's going to be pressured to show where that money came from. Why did it move from account A to B to C, in the 90 days before you made the application? And so you're then going to have to go back and say, okay, why did I do this? How did I do this? Again, doing nothing wrong, it's just causing confusion. So those are, I think, very important things to do. That, people can avoid without it being a big issue.
Well, so we are just about at the end of our time. So, any final thoughts on this topic, things you want to leave our listeners with?
I just ask that everybody who's already in this business do the most they can to educate and make people feel comfortable. Because once people feel comfortable, if they're in at any level in the position to buy a home, it's because they've done intelligent things, whether it's in their work or their life, to get them to this point to be able to explore it. The more information that you give them about how things work today, which is going to be different than it did a week ago and certainly a year ago, will make all of this work better. And get more people into homes. And the more people we can get into homes because other people are willing to move on, it will to some degree help the fact that, there haven't been enough homes built so that we need to use what's available.
Is there a website or social media that you would like to throw out where people can find you?
Very, very simple. If you send me a text message at 914-380-0600, I will send you my Instagram, my Facebook, my other things. I also, I will send you a link to the book or the physical book. So 914-380-0600 for a text. I'm not going to give you my email address because I can't remember it. Just do that, and I'm happy to take care of it.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Solomon. We've been speaking with Solomon Skolnick of United Mortgage Corporation. We appreciate your time, and thanks for speaking with us today, sir.
David, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm very appreciative.
Absolutely. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the MP Access podcast. We will see you next time, and thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out, and we'll see you next week.